Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Contraception, Pregnancy, Delivery, and Childcare After a Diagnosis of ADEM, NMOSD, and TM. This is the second in a two-part series covering these important issues. You can access part one on our website at myelitis.org. I am Gigi DeFebri from the TMA. We are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is made possible in part through the generous support of Alexion Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. Alexion Pharmaceuticals is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through the innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist is driven by the knowledge that people's lives depend on their work. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message to the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Eve Hampton, Paula Hardiman, and Dr. Amy Bednar. Paula Hardiman is a physician assistant and the lead advanced practice provider in the neuroimmunology program at UT Southwestern Medical Center. She graduated from Texas A&M University with a Bachelor of Science degree in biomedical science and received her Master of Physician Assistant Studies degree in 2004 from UT Southwestern. After completing PA school, she worked in a primary care internal medicine office, where she was able to implement many programs to help patients learn about and better manage their chronic diseases such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and asthma. In February 2010, Paula joined the neuroimmunology program. Not only is she involved in the evaluation and treatment of patients with demyelinating disorders, but she also develops and coordinates various research projects and health wellness programs. Eve Hampton is an avid athlete who was diagnosed with transverse myelitis when she was 13 years old. Ms. Hampton grew up in the Seattle area and attended the University of Arizona in Tucson on academic and athletic scholarships for the university's women's wheelchair basketball team. After graduating summa cum laude, Ms. Hampton received her master's degree in counseling from Arizona State University. Before moving back to the Pacific Northwest and becoming a mother, she was an academic advisor at the Mel and Enid Zuckerman's College of Public Health at the University of Arizona. She now plays for the National Wheelchair Basketball Association Seattle Women's Wheelchair Basketball Team and is an assistant coach for the Seattle Sonics Division I team in the United States and for the Edmonton Inferno, part of the Canadian Wheelchair Basketball League in Edmonton, Alberta. Ms. Hampton now resides in Portland, Oregon with her husband and 10-month-old son, Ari. And Amy Bednar received her medical degree from the University of Texas Medical Branch and completed her OBGYN residency at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. She completed her maternal fetal medicine fellowship and master's of clinical research at Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Bednar is a board certified OBGYN, fellow of the American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and by virtue of her recent fellowship graduation, is board eligible in maternal fetal medicine. She has published several articles in peer-reviewed journals regarding multiple gestations and timing of delivery. Her research interests include amniotic fluid volume regulation, multiple gestations, and diagnostic ultrasound. At the Legacy Center for Maternal Fetal Medicine, she enjoys the variety of managing all aspects of pregnancy from prenatal diagnosis to labor and delivery. Dr. Bednar spends her free time outdoors, hiking, camping, skiing, and traveling with her husband. Welcome and thank you all very much for joining us today. So just to begin, Eve, can you just give a little bit of background about your story, you know, your diagnosis, transverse myelitis, and your life since then?
Sure. Okay, I'll just try and summarize the last almost two decades of my life. So I'm Eve, and I am 29 years old, and I contracted transverse myelitis when I was 13 years old. At the time, I was growing up in Seattle. And I know that there's been a lot of research in the area of these rare neuroimmunological diseases in the last 15, 16 years. And so I'm actually not entirely sure if what I have is transverse myelitis or AFM or one of the other subtypes, but we'll call it transverse myelitis. But the result is that I'm a paraplegic, complete T3 on my left side and T10 on my right side. Those of you that might be listening that have transverse myelitis, you might know that sometimes we get some kind of wonky paralysis out of this condition. And that asymmetry actually played a little bit into my pregnancy. So I think there was a little bit in the background about kind of my education background, but basically, in very short summary, I grew up playing wheelchair basketball and ended up at the University of Arizona playing wheelchair basketball in college, and then went on to get my master's degree in counseling and played basketball then and now, which is a huge part of my life, and one of the reasons that I timed my pregnancy, sorry, that was my phone, when I did. I basically decided that I wanted to get pregnant at the end of a basketball season and then be ready to play again this season. Pregnancy does not always work on that type of schedule. For me, it did. I was using Mirena. I know there were a couple questions that maybe come in later about birth control in general. But I was using Mirena, and I talked to my OBGYN and said, okay, I'm ready to get pregnant. What should I know? And she said, don't worry, you're going to have a totally normal pregnancy. And so I didn't worry at all. And we'll talk a little bit later about how Dr. Bednar became my MFM, maternal fetal medicine doctor, which are doctors that work with more high-risk populations, which is what I ended up with by the end of my pregnancy. It wasn't totally a normal pregnancy. But I did get pregnant right away after my IUD was removed, and I now have a 10-month-old son. He was born in January. He was due in February of this year. It's kind of hard for me to describe the whole pregnancy, but I'll tell you that it was basically perfectly normal for the first two trimesters, and then right around 29, 28 weeks, I went to see my OBGYN, and that is about the time, and Dr. Bednar, correct me if I'm wrong, is that about the time when you do your first cervical exam?
That's the time when we do recommend starting to do, you know, serial cervical exams in people with, you know, who have lack of sensation in their, you know, uterus and pelvis from whatever spinal cord paralysis they may have.
Okay, so and so that being the time to do that was when my regular OBGYN did that first cervical check, because I don't have sensation. What she found was what she thought was that I was 80% effaced, which means that my cervix was thinning and that there would be basically a high risk for preterm labor, which is obviously very dangerous for a child to be born that early. There can be a lot of complications with that early of a preterm birth. And so I was referred over to the maternal fetal medicine department at Legacy, which is where I met Dr. Bednar, and she followed me for the rest of my pregnancy. And I think that I learned a lot about my cervix, and so did everybody else at the hospital. I think I got like probably more cervical exams than most pregnant women do, paraplegics or otherwise. But I think that this is what I came away with more than anything else in my pregnancy, although there are some other points that I'm going to get to that you might want to watch out for if you are a paraplegic in general or have transverse myelitis or are a doctor working with someone. But what I found out is that my cervix, because I have no tone or low tone, kind of similar to how I have a neurogenic bladder with no tone or low tone, is not normal. And therefore, when it was checked, it didn't feel normal. It felt like I was 80% effaced. But some of that is just the way that my cervix is. And I think that going forward, if I decide to have another child in the future, I'll probably work with Dr. Benner or another doctor so that we can do a cervical exam prior to my pregnancy, or at least really early on, to kind of get a baseline of what that feels like. So when the first cervical exam comes along, there's some knowledge of what that feels like, because it's not going to be normal, if that makes sense. Does that sound right, Dr.
Totally agree. Yeah, okay. I totally agree. That's my plan for you.
Okay, very good. So some other points to think about when you're pregnant, and then I think we'll get to some of the questions, is that I self-cath because I have a neurogenic bladder, and typically I cath, like, I don't know, 6-8 times a day, maybe less, maybe more, depending on how much liquid I'm consuming. But when I was pregnant, when I had a baby kicking my paralyzed bladder, I was cathing up to 15 times a day, and I was having incontinence all the rest of the time. So that's something that's really exciting to look forward to. That is something that, you know, all women who are pregnant have to deal with, having bladder and bowel issues, constipation, but it provides a special set of excitement for those of us who are paraplegics. I definitely think that, you know, pregnancy is extremely individual. Transfer myelitis and all of the other rare diseases are also going to be very individual. So the best advice that I can give is to work with your doctors early, get a full physical exam early, and you know, do your own research, because I think that we all know that we have to be advocates for ourselves, because there's not that much knowledge in the general population and not that much knowledge in the even in the medical field about the nuances of our diseases. So the more that we know, the more that we can direct our providers to do their own research, which they will do. But you might have to point them to places like the TMA or any research that you might find, or this podcast. And I think I will turn it back over, and you guys can ask any questions. Obviously, I'm pretty candid, so that's it.
Great. Thank you so much. It is really great to kind of start this with a personal story, because it, you know, kind of gives context for these questions that we've, you know, received from people. And, you know, it's great. So thank you very much. So to begin, I figure it's good to start kind of at the beginning. We're just talking about whether or not rare neuroimmune disorders like transverse myelitis or neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder influence fertility. So Paula or Dr. Benner, if one of you could address that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, I from my perspective, you know, I think at least with regards to transverse myelitis specifically, I'm not aware of any literature that suggests increased risk of miscarriage or infertility with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. There is a couple recent papers in the journal, a recent paper in the Journal of Neurology that I think as more information is becoming available regarding this more rare disorder, there is an increased risk of miscarriage, which doesn't necessarily affect your, you know, it's not affecting your ability to conceive, but certainly obviously affects your pregnancy outcomes. And I admit that I my assumption would be that the better the disease is controlled, the better the disorder is controlled with neuromodulators, that, you know, which we'll talk about later when we get to medications. You know, I think I hope that it decreases the risk of miscarriage, but I don't think that that's very well known, at least not, I don't know that it's been well studied yet. Certainly, So at least for those two specific disorders, there's some information. And I, you know, I don't think infertility is definitely a very complicated subject. So I think that, you know, involving, especially depending on your age, you know, as you get closer to 35, women who have transverse myelitis or neuromyelitis and other rare disorders that we're talking about today, that, you know, should have a lower threshold to be seen by an infertility specialist and to address these concerns, because you don't want to wait too long and then have been trying for, you know, years and not have been seen and evaluated. So I think that's an important, you know, people waiting too long, and especially once you get closer to advanced maternal age, which is 35 years old, can become, you know, add complexity to an already complex situation.
Great, thank you. And then, so since, you know, in general, fertility is likely to not be affected. I mean, there's, of course, there could be under, you know, unrelated fertility issues, but, mm-hmm. you know, so if people are trying to not get pregnant, you're likely to be using birth control. So are there any concerns with certain types of birth control in individuals with these disorders? For example, using estrogen-containing methods because of, you know, clotting or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Paula may have some thoughts on this as well, but I, at least from my perspective as an OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine doctor, I think it really depends on the patient, the person's mobility. And I think that certainly with regards to estrogen, you know, I think I would, you know, having estrogen-containing hormone options are thrombotic and probably less than ideal in a patient population that is less mobile. And, you know, obviously, as Eve said, these conditions are very variable. So I think it a little bit depends on the person and their range of mobility and their activity level. I mean, you don't need a lot of mobility to prevent a blood clot, but certainly it's something to think about. With regards to progesterone, I think in terms of low-dose oral progesterone or a Mirena IUD, which has, as you talked about, has progesterone in it, I would not expect increased risk of osteoporosis or thrombotic events. But Depo-Provera in long, which is an injection an injection that you get every 3 months, as many of you probably know. There's more and more data that it does have long-term effects on bone health. So with regards to increasing the risk of osteoporosis in the general population, so in a population that already has risk of ulcers and other compromise, I think Depo-Provera would be kind of pretty low on my list of choices for contraception in patients with paralysis.
No, I agree with Dr. Bednar. As long as my patient is pretty much mobile for the most part, we tell them we don't have a concern with using the typical oral contraceptives for birth control options. If the patient is just sensitive to the estrogen component or there's maybe some other risk factors that make it not the best option, I will tell them that, you know, there's other things to consider, with one being the Mirena IUD becoming more of a popular option with some of our patients. I think primarily because it's just, you don't have to worry about with taking a pill every day, and it can also help if you have issues with heavy periods. It can help decrease the menstrual cycle. Some patients can actually become amenorrheic on with the Mirena IUD, or you just have a cycle that's maybe 1 or 2 days long.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll just add in anecdotally that something to consider if part of your condition involves paralysis is, especially if you have a neurogenic bladder, that if you do get chronic UTIs and you have to be on antibiotics frequently, that would be something that you definitely want to discuss with your doctor with regard to oral contraceptives. Is that correct?
Yes, I definitely. And I think that's, you know, another plug for long-acting reversible contraceptives like the Mirena or the Paragard, which is a non-hormonally based copper IUD that lasts for 10 years, as well as the Nexplanon, which is a little toothpick-sized device that goes in the arm. You know, those methods are not affected by antibiotics, particularly the IUD. So, I think that's an important consideration.
Right. Thank you. And Eve, you mentioned that you, you had the Mirena IUD. Did you experience any issues in terms of, that's a type of birth control that a healthcare provider has to insert. So in terms of getting a clinic where there is an accessible exam table or anything like that?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I've been really lucky that I've had exceptional providers. Because I have never had problems getting accommodations. I will say that I am a very strong self-advocate, and I'll tend to go in and say, we might need a nurse that can hold this leg, and I'll hold this leg. And so I think you have to just, put your pride at the door sometimes when you're going into the OBGYN, whether or not you're a paraplegic, but you certainly might need, a few more people in the room to make things physically work, but it's totally okay. I know that some people may have more or less comfort with that, but I would encourage you, everyone's there to help, so just tell people what you need.
Great, thank you. And so, we talked a little bit about this, but some people, Evie mentioned antibiotics for chronic UTIs. So many people with these disorders may be taking medicine that may interfere with the effectiveness of their birth control pills. So what are some alternative contraceptive methods that won't necessarily be affected by these medications?
I think like we've alluded to or said, the IUDs can be an option that will not interfere with the medications, whether patients are on anti-epileptics or having to take antibiotics for recurrent infections. So that's one good option. Then to me, you're just going into the using condoms or using different spermicides, which can just have a whole host of different compliance issues, I'll say, and may not be as effective as having the IUD.
Right, I agree. I think we talked about the long-acting reversible contraceptives like the Mirena and the Paragard IUD. The Nexplanon is a good option. This may be less than ideal in a paraplegic or quadriplegic, but the NuvaRing, particularly if people have autonomic dysreflexia, this would probably be less than ideal. But there is the NuvaRing, which is a ring that goes in the vagina, around the cervix, but it is something that you would have to change every 3 weeks, every month, every 3 weeks or every month, and that is an option.
And
but
you
it's,
may not, oh,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, Dr.
Go ahead.
Benner. But I explored the NuvaRing myself, and mm-hmm. We decided that there may not be enough tone for it to stay in the right
yeah.
spot. So
right.
That's something you may or may not have tone, but consider that.
And then,
right.
If you're done with child bearing, then the safest, least risk to the woman is a vasectomy.
Right. And another issue potentially with the NuvaRing is depending on if someone has limited hand function, it might be a little bit more difficult to insert and remove. But I think that speaks to the fact that it's, important to kind of bring up all of these issues with your healthcare providers to make sure that, what they're, they're aware of what you're able to do and not, and kind of help you brainstorm through that. So just moving along, one of our members asked, they said that their period negatively impacts their TM symptoms. So is it, can they expect the same from pregnancy?
So I usually, when my patients, especially once they get past their first trimester, it seems like once the hormones really start to level out and you have an increase of a lot of the good pregnancy hormones, that their symptoms actually become more stable and they actually feel better while pregnant. And so I don't think, it's kind of more reassuring for the patients that actually when they're pregnant they feel better and they don't have to take as much as some of their symptomatic medications depending, making sure that it is agreeable to take while pregnant. But they seem to do better from a symptomatic standpoint when it comes to their symptoms.
I think that I agree, and I think also for the more autoimmune mediated disorders, I would expect that their symptoms would be less in pregnancy with the immunosuppression, that occurs.
Okay, and so also, what are some issues that might occur during pregnancy? So Eve, you talked a little bit about this, but if someone has paralysis, are there potentially more bladder issues, pressure sores, neuropathic pain, autonomic dysreflexia? Eve, I guess if you want to start and just give, if you've had experience with any of these issues during your pregnancy.
The short answer is yes, I had issues with almost all of these during my, well, that's not entirely true, but these were all concerns during my pregnancy. And if they're concerned for you when you're not pregnant, they should be even more of a concern for you when you are pregnant. Bladder issues, the incontinence is, of course, a total pain once you have like a larger fetus in you who is going to put a lot of pressure on your bladder. But also, I typically don't get that many UTIs, maybe one a year, two a year, which is, I think, a pretty low number for someone that self-caths. But when I was pregnant, I was getting them all the time. And so I did end up on a antibiotic for, like, prophylactically for the, at least the third trimester of my pregnancy, and that seemed to work really well. So pressure sores are something you really need to consider because you're, like for me, I have a cushion that is set up for my non-pregnant body. And when I was pregnant, I had pressure in different areas. And so I didn't get any, I don't think I had any pressure sores or anything while I was pregnant, but it was definitely harder to transfer, so there was more friction, and so there was a greater risk of shearing injury as well as all these other pressure areas. I do not have neuropathic pain, so I'm going to let the experts address that. And I also do not have autonomic dysreflexia. However, that was a major, major concern of all of my providers. And I think, in one part, this is a liability issue for them. And in one part, it's, of course, a real concern. Because even though in the last 15 years, I've never experienced autonomic dysreflexia, if there was one thing that was going to trigger it, it would be childbirth. And autonomic dysreflexia, I'm going to let one of the doctors explain that a little bit better, but because I'm a little bit less familiar since it's not something that I experience, but it can be deadly. And I think the layman's explanation is that if there is something going on with your body below your level of paralysis, that if you were not paralyzed, you may feel, let's say, pain, for example, like let's say I've stubbed my toe, but I can't feel it. Autonomic dysreflexia will allow your body to know that there is something going wrong. And so I think that your blood pressure drops or raises. I'm going to let the doctors cover this one. Clearly, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so I'm sure Paula can maybe even speak to this even better than me, but certainly, anyone that's had spinal cord injury or transverse spinalitis or any kind of paraplegia or quadriplegia is at risk of autonomic dysreflexia. And for Eve, as she said, you know, she never had an episode, but I was very anxious and paranoid about her having the trigger be labor or the vaginal delivery, episiotomy if that was needed. And so if ever there was a stimulus that would provoke this, then I thought pregnancy is certainly a time when it could be significant. So it is, as you said, basically it's an exaggerated sympathetic nervous system response, which is like your fight or flight nervous system that basically goes into hyperdrive and causes significant hypertension, high blood pressures. Sometimes you get hyperthermia where you feel really hot, your skin, you get goosebumps, spasticity, you can have pupils can dilate, you can have respiratory issues, loss of consciousness, and convulsions. And it can be, symptoms can be mild when it's early onset, and you get nausea and kind of bad headache and blurry vision and flushing and twitching, feeling of anxiety. Your heart rate drops, and you can also have arrhythmias that can be very dangerous. And then the reason this is a problem in labor is because it can result in that vasoconstriction, or the blood vessels contracting in the uterus and placenta, which then results in effects on, in addition to the obvious problems for the mom with severe range blood pressures causing stroke-like complications. For the baby, it can cause fetal distress and drop in the baby's heart rate, requiring emergent delivery via cesarean. So, knowing the diagnosis and initiating the appropriate therapy and being in a hospital where there's an anesthesiologist or critical care provider immediately available is critical, no pun intended, and can be life-saving. If you miss the diagnosis, then there can be severe complications, obviously for the baby, but also for the mom, because obstetricians were really good about, monitoring the baby and getting the baby out quickly. You can have a baby out in under a minute if you really needed to, but for the mom, if the diagnosis is missed, it can lead to significant vascular complications in the brain, retinal hemorrhage, et cetera. So the triggers tend to be, for some people, it's digital exams. Fortunately for Eve, that was not the case, but it can be the speculum or doing the contractions. Some people have it from their catheters. Constipation, bowel obstruction, decubitus ulcers, infections, even sexual activity or a fracture. So we recommend routine bladder catheterization during labor and delivery, and having an anesthesia consult in the third trimester to discuss these issues and have a plan. And we also recommend an epidural anesthesia at the onset of labor. Eve and I had some discussions about this, as she was a little hesitant to have the epidural, but eventually I think she did end up getting it. And there are some other medications that can be used as prophylactic therapy, like nifedipine, which is a blood pressure medicine, and terazosin, which is another medication that can block the sympathetic response, particularly in quadriplegics. Also are some reports of people who have severe autonomic dysreflexia having neuroablative procedures like a sympathectomy or cordectomy, sacral neurectomy. So obviously that would be in if you have severe autonomic dysreflexia, or if you've ever had it, I strongly recommend a preconception consult with maternal fetal medicine or perinatologist, the same thing, to discuss and with your primary provider to have a plan for management.
I think Dr. Bednar is right on. I think it's one of those things that we know can be a potential complication, and so you just need to be aware of it and identify it early, and then there are ways to intervene so you don't have to have all the scary potential complications. But it's getting with a OB-GYN and having an anesthesiologist who are aware and know how to monitor for such potential complications that could occur.
Thank you. And Paula, individuals with these disorders sometimes may have scoliosis and get a fused spinal cord, as a result of that. And have you seen that in any of your patients, and does that affect a pregnancy?
Having scoliosis with trying to have?
Right.
So actually, unless they have a very severe scoliosis, it shouldn't be an issue. But you're correct, some patients, especially if you're in a wheelchair, you can start to have a little bit of a curvature of the spine. And so from my experience, that has not been a issue with delivery in any way. But these have been patients who've also just only had a mild curvature in the spine.
Okay.
Again, then, anecdotally, I do have scoliosis. I had it before I was paraplegic, and I have it much worse now. And that was definitely like the least of my concerns while I was pregnant.
Yes.
Okay. And then what needs to be considered before someone decides to become pregnant? For example, whether the medications they're on would affect the pregnancy, or anything else. I guess, Paula, if you could just start and give a little bit of information about that.
Yes, there are certain medications that we can use for neuropathic pain, some of the anti-epileptics that can be actually harmful to a baby. So we'll have our patients come off of those medications. There's some of the immune suppressants that shouldn't be used during pregnancy either. And so we'll have patients come off and really work close with the OB-GYN, especially if there's a little bit of depression and other anxiety issues, as to what type of medications can we safely leave patients on to try to get pregnant and stay on throughout the pregnancy. But I try to do my best to get my patients off of everything they possibly can, because I don't want to have anything that could potentially impact the baby.
And Dr. Bednar, you mentioned this earlier, that there have been some studies that show an increased risk for miscarriage in individuals with NMO. There's also been some that show potentially an increased risk of relapse after birth.
Right.
So if you just talk a little bit more about, the issues, potential issues with NMO, and then, the medications that are used with someone with NMO, during pregnancy and or breastfeeding.
Right. Sure. So there's been some recent papers that have shown. So one issue with NMO and pregnancy is, and then this seems to be related to the higher estrogen levels during pregnancy and their effect on the aquaporin, the underlying complication and the autoimmune process. But there's been, usually when you have an autoimmune disorder in pregnancy, like something like lupus, the the relapse tends to be more common after delivery. Usually someone will be immunosuppressed during pregnancy, and then after postpartum, they tend to have a flare in that first kind of 2 to 6 weeks postpartum, as the pregnancy hormones are decreasing and the immunosuppression is decreasing. So because the something about the way that the antibodies that are involved in NMO and their how they bind to the protein, the aquaporin 4, which is the protein that's involved in the disease of NMO, pregnancy makes that worse. And so through that mechanism, the risk of preeclampsia, the risk of miscarriage, and the relapses can be more significant during pregnancy. Fortunately, the acute treatments used for NMO in the setting of a flare, like IV steroids or plasma exchange or IVIG, are all treatments that we use for other diseases, other complications in pregnancy, and all have been, I mean, certainly they all have risk and benefits. If somebody were to have a severe relapse and require those treatments, as they do in the acute setting of NMO, IV steroids and plasma exchange and IVIG are all therapies that can be used if needed in the pregnancy or postpartum period. And certainly it's a discussion of risk and benefits. After the first trimester, really the risk of steroids is primarily just making people more insulin resistant and having development of diabetes during pregnancy, which is its own can of worms, but something certainly easily managed by a skilled obstetrician or maternal fetal medicine doctor. Plasma exchange and IVIG have their own issues, but really are, it's all, if we're at the point where we need something like that, then it's, obviously our primary responsibility is to the mother, and the better you take care of the mother, the baby, the better the baby does. With regards to the medications, as Paula alluded to, the primary medications that are used with NMO, the rituximab, Rituxan, is category C and is probably the safest in pregnancy. Celcept and azathioprine are kind of lower on the list of things that we would prefer to use. With regards to rituximab, it has not been shown to have adverse outcomes in pregnancy. Has not been shown to cause developmental issues. And with regards to lactation, it's sort of an unknown, a little bit unknown. But basically, the recommendation is that, at least on the product label, is that breastfeeding be avoided in a woman who is treated with rituximab. Pediatricians are, very conservative in general about medications, and so unfortunately, most of the medication, all the medications that are used with NMO are not ideal in breastfeeding, except for prednisone. Celcept and azathioprine should be, Celcept for sure should be, is teratogenic and causes birth defects. Should certainly be stopped prior to pregnancy. It causes abnormal facial development and heart defects, and really probably people should be off of it for 2 to 3 months before conceiving. And the breastfeeding data is it's also not recommended in breastfeeding. And then with azathioprine. Azathioprine has some case reports of possible congenital abnormalities, small heart defects like holes in the heart and preterm delivery, some neonatal immune or hematologic problems, possible growth restriction. So as Paula said, I think you want to be, if you have to be on it, you want to be off of it ideally in the first trimester and preconception, and then use it only if it's necessary for, life-saving therapy and the discussion of the risk and benefits in terms of the patient's risk of, having an acute flare is certainly something to be considered. I believe it's also contraindicated in breastfeeding, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you. And then we just received another question, actually, going back to something about contraception. Someone asked if there is a danger of infection associated with using non-hormonal or, for example, Paragard, the copper IUD, specifically in people with transverse myelitis.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I guess, are they referring to like sexually transmitted infections, or because I know the IUDs from back in time, there was always this concern of getting like pelvic inflammatory disease, because people would have unprotected sex and then get a sexually transmitted infection, and so, but we're not seeing that nowadays with the IUDs. I don't know if it's because people are more responsible with their sexual activity, but as far as like increasing like bladder infections or anything, no, not, there's nothing I've seen with my patients that have IUDs.
Okay,
I agree.
Okay, thank you. And then, you know, another question is, if someone has weakness or paralysis from transverse myelitis, is something like a C-section necessary, or is it possible to have a vaginal birth as well?
I'll start with this. This is Eve. I had a vaginal birth, and I ended up being induced in part related to transverse myelitis and my paralysis, and in part related to some potential issues unrelated to my paraplegia. But the concerns for me, I was definitely worried about having to have a C-section. I did not want to have a C-section. I don't know that anybody necessarily wants to have a C-section, but I was ready to have one if that is what was needed, of course. But being a complete paraplegic does not mean that you have to have a C-section. I was concerned that in addition to being a paraplegic, that I was also going to have this epidural because of the risk of autonomic dysreflexia, which would mean that any sensation that I would have, then I probably wouldn't have anymore. And so I had a lot of concerns about that, but what actually ended up happening was a pretty lengthy induction, but they ended up breaking my water, and with the help of some biofeedback from the monitors, that the internal monitors, so I could actually see when I was having a contraction, as well as some feedback from the doctor that was doing my, the hospitalist that was doing my delivery, and she would tell me when to push. I was able to push that baby out.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So Paula and Dr. Bednar, do you have anything to add, you know, as your experience with, as healthcare providers?
Yeah, so I thought, for some reason, I thought you did get an epidural, Eve. I think, you know,
I
as...
I did get an epidural.
You
correct.
Did get one, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. We just waited a little bit longer than we had originally intended, I think. Right. But yeah, so I think, you know, in the literature, several series have looked at, you know, the incidence of the rate of spontaneous vaginal delivery in people with spinal cord injury and paraplegia from other EDA. Etiologies, and about a third of women deliver, 37% deliver spontaneously, as Eve did. 30% have an assisted vaginal delivery, like with forceps or a vacuum, and about 30% end up with a C-section, which is the kind of national rate for cesarean delivery anyway. So you certainly do not have to have a C-section, and I would, if a provider tells you that, then you need to ask for second opinion, because that's not...
I agree with that. Definitely ask for a second opinion if they tell you have to have a C-section.
Right. I mean, only in the setting of an emergent situation with autonomic dysreflexia, if the baby's not close to being delivered and you're in the maternal situation is out of control, that would be the one scenario where, and that's, you know, any pregnancy, any
right.
maternal issue. And so, you know, certainly there are people who... you know, a forceps delivery is something that we only do, you know, an assisted vaginal delivery, like with forceps or a vacuum, is only done for fetal indications. And I think the general, you know, in some certain leave moms who are unable to push, and fortunately Eve was able to, figure out how to push. And I think it can be challenging for people depending on their level of paralysis, but it's certainly worth the attempt You know, one thing we haven't really discussed is that, you know, the biggest, you know, one of the other main risks that we talked about having vaginal exams at 28 weeks is the risk of unattended birth, secondary to unrecognized contractions, and that's the reason why you need cervical exams starting at 28 weeks and why some people end up in the hospital, and it's certainly something to be considered. You want to balance the, you know, timing of delivery for the baby as well as for the mom, and but a heightened awareness of that risk of out-of-hospital birth is important. And every, you know, as Eve said, every person with paraplegia has a sort of a variable experience and ability to recognize contractions. And we worked a lot with Eve on learning to palpate her own contractions and getting as best she could in terms of recognizing when she was having issues.
And this, for me, this is Eve again, that was probably my biggest fear at the end of pregnancy, was having a spontaneous home birth. We actually bought, you know, like a clean pair of scissors. We learned all the things that we would need to do. But that's just in part my personality, and I'm like anxious and overprepared. But it was a real concern of mine because I could not tell when I was having contractions. And I was worried that I would like fall asleep and wake up and there would be like a baby. I don't know how irrational that is, but I was definitely worried about that, which was one of the reasons that I ended up being induced, because I went in at 36 weeks, and at that point I was about 8 centimeters dilated, so it probably would have been irresponsible for them to send me home, but that was kind of when the induction was started.
Okay, thank you. And then we got another question. This is related to kind of the more, you know, childcare part of this podcast. Are there any protocols for lactation related to transverse myelitis? So like any specific issues that may arise or things to be aware of?
So I guess this maybe is more of a question of logistics. So if you're a paraplegic or quadriplegic, you can definitely breastfeed unless, you know, it's contraindicated because of medication, in which case that's something that you're going to need to discuss with your pediatrician. Obviously, if you need to be on medications that are going to keep you healthy and you shouldn't be breastfeeding, then you shouldn't be breastfeeding because you're not going to be breastfeeding anyway if you're unhealthy. But some tips that I have would be to get a boppy or another type of nursing pillow. And you can strap those around your body and then the baby can lay on there and, you know, you learn to breastfeed and the baby learns to breastfeed. It's definitely like a little dance that you do. And it's practically, you know, hands-free once you get the hang of it. So even if you don't have full control of your hands, that shouldn't be an issue. I would recommend working with a lactation consultant, even if you're having little difficulty getting a baby to latch, which my son had a lot of latch difficulties at the beginning, so I had to see lactation consultants anyway. But they can help you with some of the positioning and that sort of thing. And then the other recommendation is just watching a lot of videos about breastfeeding, so you can kind of visualize what things are supposed to look like. And one thing I wish I would have mastered much earlier was how to do side-lying breastfeeding, which is where you can lay in the bed with your infant and they can breastfeed, where you're both on your side facing each other, like tummy to tummy. And that is a lifesaver for paraplegics and quadriplegics because you can lay there and breastfeed. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, that's great. That it's good. You know, it's of course really great to get, you know, hear your personal experience. And so for, yeah, the healthcare providers, are there any, you know, anything to add about breastfeeding and, you know, with regards to having a diagnosis like transverse myelitis?
No, I think it's, you know, if the mom wants to breastfeed, I encourage all my patients to breastfeed, unless, like Dr. Bednar said, there's some contraindication because of the medications that they're on. But I try and work very close with the OB gynecology people to find a viable solution to allow moms to breastfeed for at least a couple months, because just the importance of trying to get breast milk and just the bonding to occur and everything, and just wanting to be supportive with my patients. Also with that said, here at UT Southwestern, we are very pro-baby, so if our patients want to have babies, we definitely encourage that. And but with anything, we want to be somewhat part of the discussion. I shouldn't say somewhat. We do want to be part of the discussion. We don't have to actually be there to help make the baby, but we want to be part of the we want to be part of the discussion and have a plan in place to either screen for potential complications or just to have different resources in place to help make the pregnancy be a safe and good one for mom and baby.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, certainly breastfeeding is really important. I always, for any patient, I, certainly strongly recommend it, but I also, would like to, encourage, I know there's a lot of mental, sometimes, depression and anxiety associated with paraplegia and quadriplegia and, as a separate part of the conditions. And if people are unable to breastfeed because of their medications or because the baby's having a hard time, I really would encourage you to not certainly seek lactation consultants and utilize your resources, as Eve and Paula have alluded to. But I I think you can't. It's really important not to beat yourself up and let that become a feeling of defeat. Because there's just some babies that are going to have a hard time breastfeeding, and that's not specific to transverse myelitis or paraplegia from any condition, and it's not not a failure on the mom's part, as long as you have made a valiant effort at attempting to. And so for some people that means pumping and having a good breast pump and being able to bottle feed your baby breast milk if your medications allow for it is very helpful. And certainly, as Paula said, certainly that first 6 weeks when the antibodies are being passed to the baby through breast milk is really the critical time period for breast milk specifically. And certainly if you can have the bonding from breastfeeding, that would be ideal. But, I think it's important to, I think, anyone with a history of depression or anxiety should be very aware of that condition postpartum. And is my plug for, keeping your provider in the loop. If you should have, making sure your family and friends are aware of your mood and not waiting too long to seek help if you feel like things are not going the way they should.
And I know that we're almost out of time, but I want to put a plug in for occupational therapists, because I think that, as our body changes during pregnancy and even more so after you have the baby and you're learning how to be a parent with a physical disability, I think it's a good time to revisit occupational therapy and try and come up with some practical solutions for daily living with an infant.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the three of you joining us today. We had a lot of questions from the community and we got to a lot of them. So thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just so everyone knows that's listening, this will be made available as a recording on our website and on YouTube, myelitis.org. So thanks again.